Friends, welcome back to the Ageless Athlete Podcast, where we tap into secrets and stories of age-defying, high-performing athletes. Today on the show, I have the rare privilege of meeting with Dr. Kevin Starr, accomplished rock climber, big wave surfer, and social enterprise CEO. Growing up in San Diego, Kevin fell in love with both the mountains and the ocean, started hiking and climbing around California, and went on to accomplish daring alpine ascents in the Himalayas, Peru, and beyond. Moving to San Francisco, Kevin found a good mentor and also started learning how to tackle big waves in San Francisco and around. Along the way, he left a perfectly good medical career to grow the Mulago Foundation, helping social entrepreneurs globally design for impact at scale. I can't wait to uncover how Kevin juggles a career as the CEO of Mulago, along with continuing to excel in the outdoors, while keeping his mind and body in great shape. Kevin, hey, how's it going this Friday fall afternoon?
Well, it seems like it's a La Nina year and the fog is in here at the beach. And we always hope that by mid-September, we're done with it. But might as well love it.
Yeah. Well, at least today doesn't seem to be. I think it's a bit overcast at Ocean Beach, but I think by now the fog has mostly burnt off, and I think it's somewhat fortuitous that we're having this conversation, and the surf season is underway, and for those of us who are not watching this, watching the video, there is this beautiful framed art of this big wave breaking in your background. If I may ask, where is this piece of art from?
It's the Waimea shore break. You can see how shallow it is at the base of the picture.
Sure, sure. Did you get it right from the artist in Hawaii?
No, I got it from IKEA. That's a dirty secret that I think I just told a bunch of people, but it's like, it costs a ton to get a picture blown up like this, but I would blow up a picture like this, and I'm literally getting, you know, silverware or some shit in IKEA, and I see this from way across the room, so it's been up there forever.
That's funny, and I don't know how many laughs you've had sharing this, sharing your little dirty secret with other admirers. Yeah,
well, I'm only sharing with you because I'm trying to get some candor or cred here.
Okay, right. You so far, you know, 2 minutes into the conversation, yes, the candor points are coming your way. But hey, Kevin, great to be connected. It's certainly been several years. Met at the gym last, and I think we also met once at Ocean Beach, which I think about the same time. I think it was a weekend morning, and it was one of those days where the waves were not very big, but I was struggling to get out. And I think you and others were like, I think you had either finished the surf or were coming back, or maybe we're going out at that time. Are you still regular at Surf at Ocean Beach, or do you gravitate to other places?
No, I'm a regular when I'm not on the beach with an injury.
Okay, fair. I think a lot of us can probably share some of those sentiments. Hey, just taking a quick step back, Kevin, would you mind sharing a little bit about what you do and the different dimensions you are involved in?
Yeah, I mean, most of my energy these days goes into my work at a foundation called Milago, and I'm the CEO. And what we do is we try to find people with solutions to poverty that we think could go really big. And then we teach them about design and strategy, and then we fund them and advise them over years, and as long as we see that they're making big, serious progress toward exponential scale, like kids' lives saved or kids literate or farmers making more money or whatever it might be. We're mostly in sub-Saharan Africa and the poor parts of Asia. But I've got about 12 people on the team. We spend about $25 million a year. And we work with a lot of funders who follow our portfolio. So all in all, we're helping move a lot of money now.
That's incredible, Kevin. And I know you've been doing this for some time now, but that was, I believe, not your original calling. So would you mind just sharing very quickly, how did you end up in this space?
Well, when I was in med school at UCSF, I started a project in the Peruvian Andes. I'd spent two seasons climbing in the Cordillera Blanca and Cordillera Huayhuash. And I started a project to train local health workers, community health workers in Peru by bringing a group of doctors and medical students down and going on tours through the mountain range to visit their towns and teach and learn. And I had a mentor named Reiner Arnhold, who was a very accomplished pediatrician who'd worked all over the world, and he was in his late 60s. And by 1993, because of the Peruvian Civil War, we'd moved the project to Bolivia, the Bolivian Andes. And Reiner suddenly, on one of the hikes, dropped dead. He had a massive stroke. And in the aftermath of that, I get to know his family, and they'd been in banking for generations. And it turned out my friend Reiner, who was kind of a dirtbag like the rest of us, had $50 million. And his family said, let's start a foundation. And Kevin, you know his work well, would you help? And then, long story short, it just got more and more interesting and took over more and more of my life. To the point where, you know, I just kind of tapered down with medicine and up with that. And I think my last patient I really saw formally was 9 years ago.
That's quite a story, Kevin. And one is, I guess, obviously in hindsight, Reinhold's family picked probably the right person. Unlikely. Maybe you did not fit the resume of somebody who would do that, but looks like they fit the perfect person to carry his work forward. And then the second thing is that is something I wanted to come to later in this conversation is kind of finding that common thread between the outdoors and the work you do. So I think you just kind of shared the genesis of that. Where can people go to learn more about the Milago Foundation and the work that you do?
We built a website that I think does a pretty good job of communicating what we do and who we do it with. And it's just milagofoundation.org. Milago spelled M-U-L-A-G-O. And people have any critique, I'd love to hear it.
Perfect. People are ready to go now. coming to a little bit of your story with the outdoors. One is, I would love to hear a little bit about the outdoor activities that you have been engaged in over the last few decades. I know you from the lens of climbing and surfing. So we'd love to hear a little bit about both of those activities, how you got started with them. And then also maybe some of your making a long question even longer, maybe some of your prouder moments with both.
Wow. Well, I'll just talk about getting started, and then you can repeat the proudest moment question if you want.
Sure.
I grew up in San Diego, and I've always loved the mountains and the ocean. And I think I was never able to choose between them. So I ended up finding some way to experience both. And my dad took me up. I first hiked up Mount Whitney when I was 11, and my dad would take, he wasn't a climber or anything, but he would take me to what back then, you know, people would get slideshows and you'd go watch, you know, what's his name, Whitaker, give a slideshow on climbing Everest. And I went to the one that was, I can't even remember who it was. But it was about Taiju Peak in the Karakoram. And I was like 15 or something. And I just thought, there's nothing that would be better than doing that. And then life took over and I started learning to rock climb at college at UC San Francisco. And I had a really good Yosemite climber named Jim Elias kind of took me under his wing. And by end of college, I was kind of competent. And then during med school, we used to go up to the weekend and we'd study in the Awani at night until they kicked us out, and then go climb as long as we could get away with in the day. And then after residency, I started doing, right before med school, it was funny, I broke my ankle really badly on a fist crack called fisticuffs in Joshua Tree. It's like this 10B, 10C overhanging fist crack. And I shattered my talus, or actually just broke it, like it was twisted, broken.
Ouch.
And then so I had this big surgery and then this long recovery. And then they told me, you know, don't do anything that hurts. Well, everything hurt. And so I was doing less and less and less and getting more and more depressed. And then I met this orthopod who said, no, 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 no. Don't, it'll stop you when it hurts. Just do it as much as you want. Do as much as you want. And that was like getting out of jail. And that summer, I first went to Peru. And we climbed a ton, and I must have hiked 100 miles with backpacks on. And I actually, my ankle started to hurt less. And when they did the surgery, they said, we're going to have to fuse this joint, this talus joint or subtalar joint by your time you're 40. And I'm 63, and it's just going, it's a little stiff sometimes, but it works just fine. I can't dorsiflex by as much as I would like to, which has relevance around surfing, but it's not disabling.
Did that, talus stiffness also hinder you from going back to that same crack in Joshua Tree and finally, I guess, completing it because you have to, you know, use your feet to jam those cracks often. And I know from experience, when you're twisting your crack climbing forces us into these, like, really, let's call them orthopedic nightmarish body positions where you're twisting and pulling yourself in contorted ways.
No, it doesn't really seem to matter. My wife and I were in Joshua Tree last winter, and just for fun, we did a little pilgrimage to fisticuffs. I thought, I know, nobody touched that thing. it kind of speaks to, like, I love long routes in the mountains. That's what I love to do. And I want to, you know, use sport climbing and short one-pitch climbs and that sort of thing to try to get better.
But I sure as hell don't want to get hurt doing that. So I'm going to treat that really gently. And, you know, maybe fisticuffs would be worth doing now, but I don't know. It just seems to have bad juju. If I want to prove something, I don't want to prove that. I don't need to prove.
Got it. Yeah, one has to be selective about one's battles. In what you just said, I picked up a few different things about your climbing history. You spoke of being inspired by, let's say, climbs in the Himalayas. I heard about Mount Everest. I heard about the Karakorams. I heard about, obviously, some of your, some of the cracks closer to you, Joshua Tree. And then I also heard about Yosemite. So over the decades, having climbed, I'm guessing, in those places and more, any particular moments stand out that you're either very proud of, or they make for just achievements that you will always take with you?
Well, the high point of my mountain career was, I guess, was Trango Tower back in 1994. And I went with Willie Benegas and Jared Ogden and Eric Brand to try a new route on it. They tried the first route on the North Face. And it ended up taking 18 days to get up and 3 days to get down. So it was 21 days on the wall. And it was just an utterly extraordinary experience. And I wouldn't do it again.
Amazing.
It was just so much work. And I think if I like one thing best of all, it's fast and light alpine climbing. And this was anything but just and light. But it was an extraordinary experience it was like being in space for 3 weeks. And we finally got up this thing. And still getting off anything that big is still itself an epic.
Isn't Trango Tower like the biggest big wall in the world, even now?
No, I think Great Trango is.
Okay.
Great Trango is unimaginably broad and high. It's Trango Tower. I mean, I tell people that Trango Tower is as if El Cap sat on top of the Mont Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to do a alpine sort of snow and ice climb, mostly snow, with some rock to get up to the base, and then you got to climb a big wall.
Yeah. And I'm guessing this was done expedition style, like you said, over 3 weeks. So were you taking a big team up there?
It was capsule style. So once you left the ground, you didn't come back down. And so you had like 800 feet of rope, 1,000 feet of rope, and you would run that up as far as you can, coming up and down every day. And then you'd move the camp up. And we only had to do two camps, if I remember right. Because you could only camp where you had some snow, and there ain't much snow on that face.
Sure. Yeah, it's so steep. Yeah, that wall, from the tiny bit I know about it, it's relentlessly steep, which means that, you know, you are...
It's the overhang. It's actually overhanging. It's kind of amazing.
Sure.
Ice will come up the top, and it would be like watching a helicopter about to crash, you know, 50, 100 feet out in the air on its way down.
That's incredible, Kevin. Any other things that you care to share about climbs closer to home?
Well, another, you know, Willie and I met up in the valley some years later. Willie Benegas is, in his way, I think, one of the best climbers in the world. And we just hadn't seen each other for a while. We just spent 3 days climbing. And, you know, because Willie was pushing me, it's like, we just did this warm up one day on the east buttress of metal. And then the next day we did the east buttress of El Cap. And the next day we did half dome bar to car in 14 hours. And that was the high point. I never approached anything like it since.
Wow. Sound like a heck of a long weekend. Three
wonderful.
And all like kind of leading up to the other. I mean,
by today's standards, it was like, you know, baby steps. But for me back then, with a good friend, it was wonderful.
Yeah, no, I not quite the same clients, but I remember one weekend where I had another really strong friend visit me from Germany. And I think over 3 days, I know we did the rostrum on the second day. And I think we did something easier on the third day. No, Royal Arches one day, rostrum second day. And then I think a hard day of cracking the third day. And the fourth day, he wanted to go and do Astroman. And I basically folded my hand and said, no, I can't. This body is not going to listen to me. In a smaller way, I can empathize. In retrospect, I am sort of in a small way proud of those few days of like being able to keep up with like a young whippersnapper. And then also, yeah, I think it was fun to kind of push myself to, as you know, as a weekend cragger and as somebody who's not really a trad climber, really, to push myself. One thing you said, which was kind of interesting, Kevin, you said, you know, that you want to use, you know, I guess, shorter climbs to train yourself for like bigger, let's say just bigger on scale adventures outside, because you don't want to get hurt, right? And it's interesting how I have the other perspective, which is I am, I guess, currently more focused. My background is more like shorter things, sport climbing and some bouldering. And for me, I've scaled back a bit on like alpine and trad climbing because I don't want to get hurt doing those things to keep me from doing like more, let's say, doing other things with climbing. So it's interesting how we both come from like these opposite.
Alpine climbing is probably more likely to kill you and maybe less likely to hurt.
Fair. Yes, exactly. And that's right. You know, it's going to be like one hell of a way to go. So just switching gears a little bit, you also surf, and I know you've been doing that for a while. Did that story begin with your childhood in San Diego? Is that where you learned to surf, and has that kind of
You know, Southern California is about cars. And I lived inland, and I didn't have a car till I was 17. So I couldn't really get to the beach, you know, as much as one could to really get into and get at surfing. And so then when I had a car, I started going up to, like, Big Rock in La Jolla. And that was a really cool wave. Then it was a kneeboarding scene. Steve Liss and all those guys, you know, very influenced by George Greeno. And so I started kneeboarding, you know, because that's just a tight little barrely wave. And kneeboarding seemed like the learning curve was shorter, and I'm naturally impatient and lazy. So I started kneeboarding, which is the biggest, I'm lucky that that's the biggest single regret of my life, because then I went up to UC Santa Cruz for college and I kept kneeboarding. I had so much fun on the North Coast, but by the end of university, I was kind of getting really intrigued with big waves, and you can't surf big waves on a kneeboard. And so I ended up going to med school at UC San Francisco. And honestly, I didn't even know there were good waves here. it was just the one use. I couldn't afford to go anything outside of California and didn't want to. And it was the one that was, I was in, I was in love with Northern California by that time. And it was the one med school that was near the ocean in Northern California. So I wanted to go there. And then I had a first year, my first year advisor in medical school was Mark Reniker. Most people know him as Doc Reniker. And so he got me out into Ocean Beach and then was kind of my mentor and trying to learn how to stand up surf and surf big waves at the same time. I mean, in retrospect, Ocean Beach is a terrible place to learn how to surf. I didn't mind the beating.
Tell me about it. 12 years in and still trying to master the basics.
Yeah, I mean, some people called me stupid because I would go out in days I probably had no business going out, and I could stick with it until I got out. And weirdly, I got better at riding bigger waves because you kind of have more time to get set. But still, you know, Ocean Beach, how many waves do you get out in a, how many waves do you get in an Ocean Beach section? You take half an hour to get out, and then some days you seem to find the rhythm and you get into the double digits, but mostly I don't. There are people who I just watch that are just machines, and I'm not that. But you just don't get that many waves at Ocean Beach compared to, you know, if you sucked it up and were surfing in a Santa Cruz reef, you just get so many more waves.
Sure. No, I think that's that is so true. Even for people who are quite dedicated, I think it's hard to predict with any reliability how a particular session might go on a proper day in the season, because Ocean Beach can be, you know, very temperamental, and it can be the sort of the great decider of how you might do on a particular day. And I did not know this, Kevin, that you were part of, Doc Reniker's school of prodigies. By the way, I am I managed to get a hold of him. So I am going to be hopefully having him on this on the show later on this season. So I look forward to that conversation, because I've never surfed or met Doc in person, but I was inspired by the New Yorker article from, you know, many moons ago. And it's great to hear that, you have surfed with Doc, when you were learning Ocean Beach. And I think you still continue to surf with him to the day.
Well, Steve, he is not really inspiring. Figure to the older surfer, because he's 8 years older than me, and he can still paddle better. He'd still get out, I think, on days. You know, everybody keeps track of the one or two days in the season when they just don't get out. And I suspect in a given season, my total is still higher.
That's amazing.
So, he's just inspiring. I'm glad you're going to talk to him. I think you'll learn a lot more talking to him than you do to me.
Different things from different people. Given that, Kevin, given that, you know, you do, you pour so much energy into your work and also into climbing and into surfing. I mean, these are like extremely, you know, time taking activities, and most people would be proud of just succeeding in just one of them. And you are doing things with all three of them. How are you able to keep them in balance? Any things you've learned over the years, any practices you follow to the day?
I read I don't really read the Harvard Business Review that much, but I just happened to see it sitting around the office once, and I read an article, and I didn't really read much past the title because I felt like somehow I didn't. The title was, "There is no work-life balance, there's only choices." And I tell my founders, my social entrepreneurs, I use that all the time. Because work-life balance is some kind of abstract thing. And choices are real. And so you can say, I'm going to surf this season. And I know what it takes to surf Ocean Beach well enough, which means get out. And it's fickle. And so you got to have a certain level of flexibility. And you make that choice. That's, I'm going to do that. And I'm also going to have a job and I'm going to work my ass off at it. But if you don't make some choices, I'm going to spend this time with my family. I'm going to spend this time surfing. If you love your work's going to seep into all the cracks. And that's actually pretty awesome unless you don't like your work. But if you want to do these other things, you have to make a choice to do it. And so I don't try to balance my life and work. Sometimes my work utterly takes over every fiber of my being and every second of my available time. And then sometimes in surf season, I don't even want to admit how little time it'll take. Same as in the summer. I want to be in the mountains as much as possible in the summer. I carve that out so that my work isn't suffering. But I'm going to do that. And I'm going to do it every year, year in and year out. Whoops, I think you might be on mute.
Kevin, yes, amazing. No, I think those might be words to live by. Yes. I think balance is maybe only temporal. And you know, choices matter more. And I think one smart choice that I can see you have made is building a home right by the water, so you don't have to spend time, admiring the ocean from a camera or from photos. You can actually be there. Any other intentional things you have done in your life? Like one thing you mentioned is training your team in a certain way. Maybe you can talk more about that. Maybe some other choices that you've made. And also, Kevin, any trade-offs there?
Any what?
Any trade-offs. Trade-offs because, again, you're executing at a high level across disciplines.
Well, you don't have a counterfactual. My assumption's always been that you take a career hit from doing this other stuff. I know people who I don't know have, and Mark Reniker has chosen a way of doing medicine that is so compatible with the surfing that I think that he has managed to do both spectacularly well, have a life in surfing and have extraordinary work. I have a more conventional work day because I have a team that I want to work with. And the one choice, I guess it's a choice, is that I'm going to do that thing. I'm going to really assiduously do that thing of hiring people that are smarter than me. So I get a team that can do stuff. Maybe as good as I can do or better than I can do. And it's the team that's going to outlast me anyway. So it's in my interest now and later to build that team. But this thing, Malaga went really slowly at the beginning. Now it's really taken off, but it went slowly because I did ER medicine when I finished because I wanted big chunks of time off. And if you work rural ERs, you can write your own ticket. And so I got to spend a lot of time doing these things as I started to build Malaga and as I had a medical career, and I could build it really slowly. And normally, if someone came to me as a founder and said, I'm going to do this thing that's going to change the world, but I'm going to do it really slowly, I'd say, well, come back when you're ready to go all out. But I had the luxury. I didn't even know what I was building. I had no long-term vision. But I do know that if you want to spend a ton of time outdoors, but have a career that is not based in the outdoors, that career is going to take a hit. And again, it's choices, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely choices. And, you know, there are different ways to look at it. I think me personally, I took some time, I've taken time, chunks of time in my career to pursue climbing, to pursue surfing. And I think I realized that I personally don't have any talent to do those things full time. So for me to be able to stay motivated and actually be motivated for climbing and surfing, I have to have like a more conventional career around, you know, doing things behind a desk and working with people. So I think for me, that balance seems to, obviously you are taking hits, but in some ways it's also kind of coming together because one thing keeps me motivated to engage and succeed in the other. I think doing just one thing makes it a little bit...
That wasn't complicated enough for me. So I married a wonderful French woman and have to be back there a lot. And my job also requires a ton of travel. And travel kills you. Like, it's really hard to stay fit when traveling. And I actually tell the people where I'm going, I'm going to have a couple hours each day for some exercise, even if we're in rural Zambia. And so, and it's not always managed. And the problem for me is there are some people who would be looking for, oh God, I can't wait till my run. And for me, it's like, okay, I carved out the time. Now I got to go run. Cause I actually hate working out in all its forms. And I do it because it makes me able to do the things I love better and longer. But God, I hate it.
I get it. No, I think it's for me again. Yeah, exercise is kind of a means to an end. And I think the sports that I engage in, I think of them as play. So Kevin, two things I wanted to ask you of that. One is, are you able to combine any of your work trips to some of these places around the world? I know that, you know, you have funded, for example, or at least looked into funding entrepreneurs in places even such as Pakistan, where the Great Triangle is. So one question I have is, if you have successfully been able to combine any trips where you've been able to, you know, climb mountains or surf with the work you're doing. Yeah. Let's start with that question first.
I do, and more in the past than I have in present, and I hope I do it more in the future, which is to say, let's see, I went to Tibet 6 times, and I didn't do any big climbs there, but I got to see and get close to a lot of mountains. And one trip to India, I ended up doing some climbing in the Garhwa.
Mm.
And I used to keep a surfboard in Liberia. It still is somewhere there. There's some awesome waves. And not huge, but some really incredible points in Liberia. In South Africa, I've got surfing friends there, so we have some stuff in South Africa. So whenever I can. But the thing that is funny is when I first did Lago, I didn't really know what a great program was and what a great solution was and how to assess a great leader. And now we go where the best ideas and the best leaders are, and they may be in Nigeria. And Nigeria is no picnic for a climber or surfer to go to. It's hot and flat, and but the people, the energy there, the exuberance, the entrepreneurship, and the generation of ideas, you got to go there if you do my kind of work. And it's going to have 1 billion people in by like 2050 or something. So you know, I tend to, and now I've got a team where like we all have to do our share of traveling. And yeah, and like two of them said, we're going to Indonesia this fall. And I'm like, well, wait a second. I want to go to Indonesia. So they went to Indonesia and they didn't surf.
Maybe, Kevin, I need to come join your team as like an intern just so I can be selfish about some of this upcoming travel your team has. Kevin, but,
the other thing I'll just mention is that sometimes you don't know. Like, I just went to Malawi. I'd never been to Malawi before. Malawi has huge granite walls that top out at 10,000 feet on the border with Zimbabwe. And then apparently there's this whole area of really nice granite domes in the north of the country. And I just wasn't tapped in and didn't know that. And now I'm like, I was leaving and I was talking to people back home. I was talking to my assistant. Can you extend this? Can I extend this? Can we put the other part of the trip back? I got to go see this. But we couldn't. So I'll have to go back.
Fair. Well, at least you got a little teaser of what's out there, maybe for a future trip, or at least to share with others who might end up listening to this and end up in Malawi at the same time. Kevin, given your hectic, your hectic routines, and you know, one of the things I'm trying to understand by talking to people such as yourself is any routines that you follow. You know, it could be things like certain exercises, working with coaches, things that you've learned over the years help you stay in some shape, that when you actually go back to surf or go back to climbing after, you know, hectic travel, you're able to jumpstart back in?
Well, more and more I'm able to keep, like, not lose too much ground on a trip. And then I just do something every day. You know, like, my office is on Russian Hill. I'm on Ocean Beach. I ride my bike as fast as I can there and back. I'll go up. I got no alternative. I'll go run up and down the dune, you know, 30 times. I'll surf. I'll rehabilitate whatever current injury I have. And, you know, now I'm realizing that, like, I'm going to be doing shoulder exercises till I'm dead. So those have to happen every day. Those stretches, those exercises, you know, stabilizing the scapula, that has to happen every day now. And core strength is going to help avoid injury. So some of that has to happen every day. And every day for me is different. Like, sometimes I might have to talk to somebody in Zimbabwe at 6 o'clock in the morning. And that day is going to look very different than the day before. So, you know, my life is chaos. And so it's just kind of like, look at the schedule, where do I have a break? And I try to tell my team and my assistant, I want a 3-hour break every day during surf season somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the bummer is when Ocean Beach goes off in the morning and you carve that out in the afternoon, and oh well.
Yeah.
But I make sure there's time to do something every day, even if it's go up the street and get on my neighbor's rowing machine or watch something on Netflix. And that's the best I can do. I'm not a very organized person. I'm not a very disciplined person. I'm just super motivated to get to do these things. I mean, I'm fundamentally lazy. The best way to do things is to do the thing. So it's surf season, Ocean Beach. I do not need other exercises after paddling out on 10-foot ocean beach.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm with you. I think the desire to do these things, I think that is paramount. And I think everything else kind of follows, like what you talked about, you know, doing rehab. I've seen that myself. I actually stopped surfing for a year and a half because I thought I had one shoulder, which was a goner. I'm 44. And I injured the shoulder climbing at a crack in Yosemite many years ago. Like, my ortho told me that short of a full shoulder replacement, a few years down, I shouldn't use it for these kind of sports. And long story short, I found a great...
Yeah, that was bullshit.
Yeah, that was bullshit. So I got, and then what's the other thing that I did in my case was I've had a climbing coach the last few years, and they took me through this assessment, and they told me that I basically have a very weak shoulder. So the rehab that they had me doing to get stronger for climbing got my shoulder stronger and mobile enough that in a recent trip, and a trip last month to the Dominican Republic, which I went to do something else, I actually paddled out, tentatively. And then I paddled out once, shoulder was fine, came back, stretched. And then I surfed every day of the 10 days I was there. And I was like, wow, I really started believing that, that adage where it's really, you have to listen to your body and you have to look beyond what the medical experts might tell you. Having said that, any coaches or therapists or any such professionals that you want to give a shout out to in this call?
Well, I have an orthopedist, Dave Atkin. He's a surfer, really good surfer. And so he thinks a lot about shoulders and surfing. And so he's been both a great source of advice, but also treatment and when they needed it. And but actually, it's so interesting you bring that up. I'm looking for really good coaching now. I've had some good. I can't even remember their names. I had some 2 years ago, I had some people help me with some really good work on shoulders. But honestly, I think it was pretty generic. I just needed somebody to give me some well-known stops when I was going to be reporting back into them. But I wish I had sort of discovered coaching a long time ago. Because I've been doing, that Cirque Athlete guy, have you run into him online?
What's the name again?
Remember his name. He has a program.
Surf Mastery.
Surf Athlete.
Okay.
There's probably a lot of guys, but I realized, for example.
Is this the guy who's based out in Marin?
No, I went to that guy who does paddling coaching.
Oh, yeah. Did you hear about him from Josh Weezy? Because
I heard about him from Josh Weezy, yeah. And I went to see him. And he was wonderful. And I learned two things that made a huge difference. I learned that I'd been reaching too far, basically pushing water down instead of pushing myself forward. And you hear that and you're like, what an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was probably, at least on some of my boards, sitting too far back and pushing water forward as I paddled. Mm-hmm. And when he got my weight forward under the board to the point it felt like, wow, this is too far. But in fact, he kind of showed me that, wow, this board's a lot flatter. And he also showed me how to, I needed to keep my head down because that brought the front of the board up and I was pushing water again. And I realized that probably some of my shoulder arthritis has had to do with that dumb thing of reaching way forward, thinking you're cranking, but some of your stroke is just pushing down. And think of what that does, what kind of pressure that puts on your shoulder for, 3,000 strokes in a huge session. So
yeah,
I just, and then I realized, okay, my takeoff is sort of deteriorating. And it never was, it's always been the sketchiest part of my circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And you just learned to take off back in the day by kind of watching some people, and you would hop up on the beach some, and then you would try it. And so then I found this Surf Athlete guy. I wish I could remember his name because I should give him credit. And he has this program called The Perfect Pop-Up. And he gives you all these mobility things to do and exercise things, but he's mostly teaching you the motion. And probably some surfers have seen that video from Slater's Surf Ranch where he does slow-mo and all these pros take off.
I have seen that video. I don't know that was that individual, but yes, I have seen that particular video.
Yeah, I worshiped that video. And it was hilarious. This guy, okay, here's the dumb way to do, and many people practice pop-ups. And it was as if somebody videoed me. And then I saw that the sort of two-step back foot first way, elegant way to pop up. And I'm trying to learn it. I'm trying to learn the pop-up all over again, like tear it down to the bearings and rebuild it. And it's super fun, but it's shocking after all this time how hard it is to something I'm getting good at in my living room to 200 yards that way.
And Kevin, just so people understand, so by the way, the pop-up is also my weakest link. And I've only been at it for like a decade, and you've been doing this for several decades now, surfing that is. And I think the point I want to come across is that it's never too late to re-examine what might be a permanent habit, what might be something that we think is shear-proofed, and find an opportunity to deconstruct and to improve it. So without geeking out on this too much, man, you and I need to get together after this and talk about pop-ups and talk about shoulder arthritis, because you have a kindred spirit in me. And I would love to learn, love to learn what you've been doing, and I can share whatever couple of things that I've been doing. One thing that I wanted to kind of look at is, taking another step is habits, right? You spoke about some of these habits you have about being diligent with your rehab and looking at any other, let's say, beliefs or behaviors in the last decade you think has had the most profound impact on you?
Yeah, somebody should have a private conversation, but I think one of the main things is just taking sleep yet again more seriously. And I'm not an awesome sleeper by nature, and then there's jet lag, and I've gotten really disciplined about my jet lag routine. And I have gotten more disciplined about, that thing of sleep on this side of midnight is often more valuable. And just taking sleep more seriously and making sure I have an eight hour carve out for that. I think I seem to feel best with about 7.5, and I have to carve out 8 if I want to hit it. And some nights I still can't sleep occasionally. And it's a work in progress. And I do have a routine around it. And I don't look at devices, for at least the last half hour before I go to bed, if not better. Cold, cool, and quiet, and comfortable, and zero light. Because again and again, the research shows that any little bit of light decreases the quality. So I've been taking sleep stuff really seriously.
Super cool.
I can't stand trying to do. My life does not make eating any certain way super difficult. And I'm lazy. Don't want to spend a bunch of time preparing food and. I don't always order in the restaurant. I order what's tasty. And so, yeah, I feel like there's a lot I could do about diet that I haven't.
I was actually going to ask you about that, Kevin. Any food routines, any, I know you travel a lot, so I'm sure to some degree, it's hard for you to manage your diet. But other than that, like, you take any supplements? Are you avoid certain foods?
I do, since I seem to always be trying to heal something, I take magnesium and vitamin D. And again, you know, I've been looking at metformin and resveratrol and NMN, some of these things that have some good behind them and from the longevity research. And I'm, you know, part of me gets discouraged, like, oh God, I'd be carting all that stuff all over the world. But I'm gonna go ahead with that. I'm gonna give that a go because there's good data behind it. The guy who wrote Lifespan, got his name.
David Sinclair, maybe?
David, yeah, he's just serious, you know, he's a serious scientist. And kind of why not? I don't want to regret it later. And you know, one of the things he says is it's never too late to start. I've got these two stepdaughters that are super close to, and they're taking up climbing and surfing respectively. And I'd like to be doing this stuff with them as long as they can. I mean, you know, my stepdaughter and her boyfriend are getting better at climbing really fast. So I'm going to have a couple of rope guns in the family pretty soon. But we love going together. So whatever I can do to keep doing that. So I might even stop eating ice cream and cheese if I have to.
That would be the ultimate sacrifice, but for a good cause.
But the other thing is just staying happy. And two of the things that really help you stay happy are meaningful work and relationships. And I've always put a lot into work that luckily for me is super meaningful. And I've always had good relationships, but I'm actually putting that much more effort into them, not in some kind of mechanical way to get it happier, but you just realize they're important in all kinds of levels. And that's been a little bit of a tough one, climbing, because maybe there's some listeners. I love alpine climbing most, and I love long routes in the Sierra most. And I'm super picky about who I go with. You know, obviously they got to be safe, and you know, if they're better than me, you can do harder routes. If I'm better, we can do whatever routes I can do. But mostly I want to be, have a better friend when we get back.
Yeah, I know, Kevin, you know, you're preaching to the choir. Like, as I get old, I also get a little prickly about people I climb with, especially again, when it comes to doing longer trips to more involved climbs, because as I shared with somebody the other day, you know, when I was getting into climbing, the stroke of just being able to do routes I love was enough for me to tolerate really anybody on the other end of the rope. But now when I go climbing, like, I want the whole thing to be a rich experience. The planning, the anticipation, the co-planning, the drive to the crag, the shared meal after, and of course the actual climbing. Like, I want the whole thing to be an amazing experience. And if I think I'm not going to get that to some degree, I would almost not want to go on that climbing trip, because, you know, time is precious. And I think my richest friendships have come from the world of climbing. And yeah, I think people in my world, like people such as yourself and others, I think are inspirations. And I would only want to deepen those further and take those ahead.
Yeah, 100%. And I, you know, the last, I'm hoping to find some good partners. You know, I have my longtime partner, Michael Reeser, and we've climbed Peru and the Alps, a lot in the Sierra. And, you know, he's just had a baby, or his wife had a baby. And he's getting into paragliding, which is a really smart thing to do here in this neighborhood because you can do it when the surf is shitty. And he's a busy guy too, but I am looking, actively looking for alpine partners that want to do long moderates and just love the whole mountain experience because, and I've really enjoyed this, but the last decade has been mostly climbing long stuff myself, you know, the North Ridge of Kness, the mm-hmm. West Ridge of Kness, East Side of Whitney, the North Ridge of Lone Pine Peak. And kind of tired of that.
For sure. Devin, here's you've had all these great friendships over the years. What might be a great gift that you have given somebody?
In that realm?
Any realm.
Well, I mean, the most rewarding experiences in that regard of giving have been with the most wonderful people on earth, these people who've founded organizations that are going to have tremendous impact in the world. And there's a lot of them that I've had mentoring relationships that went well beyond my sort of job description. And it's unbelievably satisfying because they're, and it's, like most things that I do, it's pretty selfish in that it's its own reward. But I think that I've given, a lot of them have told me later about support I gave them when perhaps others weren't and they needed somebody to have faith in them.
For sure.
And I think I never pushed my stepdaughters to do these things, but I see them, I know I played a role in them taking them up. And like so many, I see all the positive effects it has in their lives.
Beautiful.
I also see the career hit the youngest one is going to take, and I give it thumbs up.
Nice. What about maybe the corollary, which is maybe what's a great gift that you have received that has made an impact on you?
Well, Mark Reniker was set up to be my mentor in medicine. And that ended up, we hit it off. And so I ended up bailing on medical school, which I basically couldn't stand. I couldn't sit through stuff. And just going to his clinic and kind of learning by, in a closely supervised way, doing. And, he didn't have to teach me how to surf big waves. that was a huge gift. And interestingly, Mark is a inveterate explorer. And as soon as wetsuits got better and better, he started exploring really cold water places. And I love exploring and I don't mind cold. And, we've ended up, he and a merry band of others have ended up, going around Iceland and going to Antarctica and going all over the Aleutians and the Alaskan Panhandle. And that was a gift because I went to a bunch of places I never would have gone otherwise. And so many people have taught me stuff that, taking the time to teach me stuff in the mountains and the water. And I've had some astonishing mentors in my early work life. So I've got a lot, and I hope I've given a fraction as much.
I love that answer. It's the gifts that you have received and the gifts that you've given, those are not one time And those have been both the gift and the recipients have been carefully selected and curated, which means that those could not have been given to just anybody. Kevin, what is, you know, you've had a world of experiences with your travels, with the work that you do. Can you think of perhaps a failure, but a failure that has taught you much?
I would say there's not some big resounding single failure, but there's just been this low-level, non-acute sense of failure and the sense that I've just never gotten good at either one of these things I love as I would like to. And but it's a kind of failure that isn't, it's not so terrible because for me, it's accompanied by the probably complete delusion that, you know what, this next year I'll be a little better. You know, because like this, and I do see that as a failure. Like, you know, there's some song by the Presidents, a band from years ago, and it's like, we're not, the song's called We're Not Going to Make It, and the lyrics are, because we don't have the talent, and we didn't put in the time. And it kind of is that, right? I'm not particularly talented as a climber or surfer. By climbing, my best talent is to absorb pain, and that's probably my best talent as a surfer. But I'm not particularly good at either one, and I know enough now that to know ways in which I could have made some different decisions. I could have looked for and gotten coaching help. I could have worked out harder. And you know, I could have hung out less on some climbing trips and climbed more. but then that's balanced off by this weird, very constructive delusion I have that next year is going to be better. In fact, if I get my pop up, if I get my takeoff done, then I could have the best year ever. And God, maybe I'll actually work on my finger strength this year. And if I did that and my fingers got a lot stronger, maybe I could climb as well as or better than I've ever climbed. And that I see that as a real positive.
Because, you know, what
and last year, I felt like I was getting there. And in January, we're just getting this amazing run of Ocean Beach surf. And I was starting to make every one. And then my board and I went on a big, big, powerful day. My board and I went in opposite directions. And I was wearing one of those thick leashes that doesn't break. Mm-hmm. And it pulled just wrong, and it tore my medial collateral ligament in my knee. And that was January 10 was the last day I surfed until a little while ago. And okay, so this year will be the best year ever. And you might as well.
Kevin, hey, you got it. Being delusional, I think the rest of the world calls it optimism. And I think I'm an eternal optimist like yourselves, even though, yes, I think I'm actually more delusional than I really should go back and think about that. But no, I think that's completely true. I mean, hey, even if we don't succeed in everything we set out to do, I think just having goals is 50%, you know. Of the whole thing. Talking of getting better in the future, and talking of having some of these hopes and dreams. Here's another question for you. Do you like your future or your past more?
Future.
Okay.
I mean, there's much that I love in my past, and there's periods of my past I wish I could do differently. But I mean, I feel consistently like in my work, I'm seeing some of my med school classmates are retiring, and I feel like I'm just hitting my stride. And so, yeah, I gotta say, aging's on my mind a lot, not because I can't remain like delusional in this constructive way, but more that I just know there is a certain amount of time that is my future. And I'm going to have to accept some stuff coming forward. I want to do so gracefully. But God, the possibilities are still really bright. And I might surf better tomorrow than I did yesterday. And why not? Why not give it a go?
I love that. Kevin, we're nearing the end of our time here, and I know that there is still some time for a sunset surf. So I just want to ask you some quick, fun, rapid-fire type of questions, and then we can call it an evening. What is a favorite meal that you could eat the rest of your life?
Some form of Japanese, you know. Just pretty basic miso and sushi and sashimi and agadashi. And I am a person who could probably eat the same thing every night.
Fair. You know, I turned a vegetarian a few years ago. I think my biggest weakness remains good Japanese food, particularly good sushi. What is I don't know if you're one to watch movies, but if you do, what's a favorite movie that you could see again and again?
My favorite movie probably of all time is Fargo, the Coen brothers. I just love the Coen brothers, and I love, you know, it's always a little bit over the top and it's exaggerated, but as a picture of human foibles and human nature. I love those guys, and I love that particular one. With more thought, I might come up with something different, but it's always the thing that pops to mind.
That's a really good one. What's a music show? I don't know, again, if you go to concerts, but is there a particular concert that you went to that you will always remember?
I go to a lot of jazz, and I love SF Jazz Center, just because how hard they're working to keep jazz alive, and because the acoustics are perfect. And I went there once to hear Stanley Clark, this legendary bass who's older than me. And he just had this drummer, Mike Mitchell, with him. And I can't remember if he was on keyboards, but it was just like watching this guy pass the torch. Because both the drummer and the piano player, this guy, Mike Mitchell on drums, he's like the future. And so you were watching this graceful kind of passing of the torch of one of the original people who took jazz bass electric, and the utter future of jazz in this intentional handover. And it sticks in my head more than any music experience I've had in years.
Sounds like a beautiful experience. And just the last question before we call it. If you were to meet the 30-year-old Kevin Starr, would you tell that person to do something differently?
Yeah, I'd tell myself to do a bunch of things differently. One thing is I would say to myself, date anybody longer than 6 months until, and if you don't feel like you want to marry him. I would tell myself to take the thing I really love and find a good coach for each of them. And I would remind myself not to hang out with anybody who did not consistently, not all the time, but consistently leave me feeling better at goodbye than I did at hello.
That's a really poignant one. Yeah, that's very thoughtful.
Any final words, Kevin, before we part?
Well, I think I've made this point enough, but you know, why not be optimistic and delusional if it helps?
Yes. I might actually have to christen this show, this particular episode, the optimistic and the delusional FTW.
Yeah.
Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I know the Ocean Beach, just the surf season is just beginning, and I'm just coming back to it. And when the beach is still not massive, I would love to paddle out with you.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks so much. This is super fun. You're doing a good thing here.
Thanks a lot. Goodbye.
Wow, what a great conversation. Many things stood out to me. Balance in our lives is perhaps a myth. There are only choices. Kevin manages to deftly weave in athletic pursuits during his work travels to far-flung corners of the globe. He shared some great tips on being flexible with the choice of exercise, as well as listening to both one's body and the mind when healing from injuries. Kevin's zeal to pursue a life of purpose while also pushing that reach of human exploration is infectious. Finally, words that stuck out to me were to spend time with people who consistently make us feel better at a goodbye than they do at hello. Funny, huh? Offline, Kevin wanted me to extend gratitude to his wife, who is happily supportive of his sports, as well as Holly Fetico, his 82-year-old body worker who has helped him tremendously. Thanks for tuning in, friends. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, like, and share with others. And don't forget to leave a review rating. Until next time, stay ageless.